right, so I'm going to start. Okay, so we're really changing tack from here on for the rest of the course. So let's just take stock on where we are. We've had search-based agents, we've had logic-based reasoning agents, and I've introduced to you planning and efficient ways of determining actions to achieve your goals. And this language, PDDL, is a fragment of a first order language to make reasoning with it efficient. And through the use of things like disjunctions and when clauses, used very carefully, you can plan for unexpected outcomes to a certain extent using conditional planning or replanning. But what we haven't done yet is really tackle uncertainty about the state you're in or about the outcomes of your actions. And for many planning problems, you really want to weigh up risks, right? So suppose that my goal is to stay dry, and I've also got a goal that I like to carry as little as possible when I go out shopping. But there is a chance of rain, and if it's raining, I'll stay dry if I've got my umbrella with me, and if not, if I don't have my umbrella with me, I'm going to get wet. And what should I do if I don't know for sure whether it's going to rain or not, given that I'd rather not take my umbrella unless I have to? Well, you know, I'm going to weigh up two things, right? I'm going to weigh up the likelihood that it will rain, right? If I'm in Scotland and I really, really don't want to get wet, take your umbrella, right? If, on the other hand, I'm in the Sahara and the chances of rain are really slim, I'll take the gamble and leave my umbrella at home, okay? So it'll depend on that, but it'll also depend on the extent to which I prefer being dry to not carrying my umbrella. Okay. If I'm not too bothered about carrying my umbrella, maybe I'll play safe, regardless of the likelihood of whether it will rain, and take it with me. All right? Now, we haven't yet been able to, I haven't provided you with a way of weighing up risk and using your reasoning about risk to decide what to do. And that's what we're going to work on for the rest of the course. So really it's about acting under uncertainty, where, unlike the symbolic approach I've presented to you so far, we are going to think about relative likelihood of things happening. When I flip the switch to switch the light on, yes, there's a chance the light won't go on, but it's such a small chance that I don't think about it when I flip the switch. I don't think, oh, it might not go on, I shouldn't do this action, I should find an action where it definitely, definitely, 100% will go on. Why? Because it's 99% likely to go on. I'll take the risk, right? And perform that action. So that's what we're going to work on. Now, so far, propositions have just been true, false, or unknown. Okay? Now, propositions out there in the world are always true or false, right? I'm talking here about your belief state, believing whether it's true, believing it's true, believing it's false, or just not knowing. That's what we've had so far. Well, I want to change that now to have a kind of spectrum between, for a given proposition, between absolute knowledge, I know it's true or I know it's false, and complete ignorance, I've no idea, to something in between, or I think it's 60% likely that it's raining outside, for example. Okay, so that's not saying that the proposition itself that it's raining is 60% true. It's my degree of belief that it's raining. That's what we're talking about here. We're quantifying degrees of belief so that we're not at one extreme, namely, I know it for certain, or I know it's false for certain, to I don't know anything about it at all, complete ignorance, to something in between, okay? My assessment that it's likely, or my assessment that it's unlikely to be true, okay? Now, rational decisions are actually made on the basis of weighing up that kind of risk. I mean, that's the way we work, all the time, even if you don't perceive that's what you're doing. When you're trying to work out a course of actions that will lead to a desirable outcome for you, you're not just reasoning about what it is you want and what it is you don't want. You're reasoning about the likelihood that your actions will achieve whatever it is you want or don't want, okay? So you're always weighing up risk and taking gambles, even if they are gambles with relatively benign effects. Some gambles have, you know, potentially disastrous effects. But if the payoff is potentially big enough and the likelihood of achieving that payoff is potentially good, big enough, you may take the gamble. Depends a little on your personality. I'll get back to that in a minute. But basically, that's what rational decision-making is. You decide the extent to which you want things. You decide, you reason about the likelihood that actions will achieve those things, and you optimize that trade-off between the likelihood of getting what you want and the degree to which you want it, okay? What we're going to be talking about today is that trade-off. And what I'm then going to be talking about is just the bit of that trade-off that pertains to likelihood, in other words, probability theory. And towards the end of the course, we will add the degree to which you want stuff theory, and then glue the two together to form this rational agent that actually takes risks and reasons about risks in a rational way. Okay? All right. So here's some examples of, I'm going to be using the Russell and Norvig example for thinking a little bit about uncertain knowledge. Okay? All right. So suppose that you've got toothache. And you want to know what, it's really unpleasant, so you want to know what's causing the toothache so you can deal with the cause and stop the toothache, okay? Now, one of the potential causes of toothache is that you've got a cavity, okay? But a rule like this is clearly wrong, right? You would be crazy in dealing with a situation where you're in this initial state with toothache and you want a goal state where you don't have toothache anymore, to utilize this kind of rule and then deal with the cavity, with stopping the cavity, because this just isn't true. There are other potential causes of toothache, right? Now, so this rule isn't true, so you shouldn't reason with it. How do we make it true? Well, we could try and make it true by adding all potential causes of toothache as disjuncts in a big fat disjunction in the consequent of this rule. If I've got toothache, then either I've got a cavity, or I've got gum disease, or I've got an abscess, or whatever, right? I could go on, as you can imagine. But this rule isn't particularly helpful either, because it makes me, if this is what all I know, absolutely all I know, where do I start? I mean, in fact, it's not even clear I can express this in a true way, because the potential causes of toothache are in principle, unbounded. I can't, you know, there are some causes of toothache I can't sit here imagining right now, but given enough time, I would imagine them. Now, it doesn't help to turn this on its head either, because suppose for each potential cause, at least the ones that I can handle, I make the cause the antecedent and its symptoms the effect. So we have rules like, if you've got a cavity, you've got toothache, for example. And then what I'm going to do is get a planner to reason with this kind of knowledge. That doesn't really help either, because it's, first of all, not strictly speaking true. You can have a cavity and not have toothache. And secondly, even if you do have a cavity, and toothache, the toothache might actually be caused by something else, like an abscess. Okay? So if you're going to rely on this kind of rule, then you could be heading up the wrong, you know, going up the wrong tree if you attempt to deal with a cavity, even if you have a cavity. And even if you deal with it, you may still end up with toothache. Okay? So if you stay within a symbolic framework as in all you've got are literals like this and disjunctions and right arrows, are Boolean operators. It's actually really, really hard to reason effectively about causes and their effects. Really hard. I mean, you look at the philosophy literature on this. My God, I mean, they've been worrying in philosophy, in philosophy of metaphysics, about causation for 2,000 years. And frankly, they're, you know, in terms of how you would represent it symbolically, frankly, they're no closer to a cogent definition of causation than they were at the start. It involves things like counterfactual reasoning and degrees of influence and dependency. All kinds of crap goes into these theories now for dealing with these crazy thought experiments they had with tortoises and hares and sticking up barriers just before winning the race and, you know, all this stuff. It's a mad literature. And it just, the fact that it is so hard to do is really a symptom of how hard it is to represent relationships between causes and their effects in a purely symbolic framework. Okay? So classical logic's not brilliant for this. Probability theory, however, may not get at causes entirely, but it does reflect dependencies in likelihood. It does do that, okay? And it allows you to bypass having to have a causal theory, a complete causal theory, because it allows you just to go with likelihood and your probabilistic estimates of what the outcome of your actions are gonna be. Even if you don't have a complete theory of the domain you're in, you can always estimate the likelihood of something, even if you're a bit ignorant, in which case your estimates are going to be noisy. At least you can act, okay? So probability theory is a way of getting over the complexity of trying to handle causal information in a symbolic framework, like the fat disjunction. It's a way of getting over total ignorance about what the underlying theory is of the domain you're in. Like, I know very little about dentistry, but even dentists know relatively little about dentistry and would find it hard to encode the domain of human teeth and disease in this kind of format. I mean, you know, even experts in the field would find that hard. So there's theoretical ignorance as well, in that you don't know the rules. There's a qualification problem, if you like, in this. You don't know all the circumstances in which an effect will occur. Will occur for sure. And it allows you to deal with practical ignorance, even if in principle you could write down. Even if in principle there is a theory that says, if this set of things is true, then for sure, 100%, this effect is going to happen. Even if in principle that's true, you may not know what that theory is, right? So there's practical bounds to our knowledge, which probability theory can help us bypass and still allow us to act, okay? So basically, probabilities are a way of summarizing a whole bunch of uncertainty and ignorance about a situation, and they're useful in that respect. And they're especially useful because depending on the kind of probabilistic model you're working with, they're really efficient to learn and to reason with. Okay? So whereas when I started out in AI in the early 80s, probability theory hardly featured at all. It all looked like this. Nowadays, machine learning, I'd say, is 90% of current AI research practice, okay? Everyone's working with statistical models, learning from observed evidence, and learning about the states that are hidden to you from observed evidence, and building systems that decide how to act on the basis of their estimates of likelihood, okay? So it's the AI way now, is to deal with statistical models rather than symbolic ones. Or at least hybrid models that are, anyway, let's not go hybrid, but there's always some statistical component. All right, but as I said, the way to think of probability is not as whether a proposition is sort of half true or half false. If you've got a probability of 0.5 on it's raining It doesn't mean it's half true, it's raining. It's raining is either true or false. Rather, that probability of a half reflects your degree of ignorance on whether it's raining or not. You kind of believe it to a degree of 0.5, if you like, where a probability of 1 means you know it for sure, you bet your life on it, and probability of 0 means you know for sure it's false. Okay? And there are varying degrees of ignorance in between about the truth of a given proposition. Okay? So don't think of probabilities as some kind of fuzzy truth value. It's degree of belief. Now, you've got kind of two kinds of probabilities, right? We can have our own prejudices, if you like, on whether something is true or not, in absence of any evidence. Or, if you're rational, so you're not like my mum, okay, who holds on to her beliefs regardless of the evidence put in front of her, like I think lots of mums do. I'm a mum, I do it as well. Anyway, you observe evidence and you revise your beliefs accordingly, right? So as we observe the world, our beliefs change. And they change because your probabilistic estimate on the truth values of things can change in the light of evidence, especially if there are dependencies among them. Okay? That's known as a posterior probability. Okay? Now, what about, how does probability then figure in rational decision making? Well, basically, if you believe game theorists or decision theorists, right? Games are just, it's just decision theory for more than one agent. We're not gonna go there. We're just gonna look at games involving one agent, right? And that's basically decision theory. And if you believe decision theorists, then the rational agent, what he does is he executes a plan that is essentially, it maximizes his expected utility. What do I mean by that? I mean that over every state, he decides the degree to which he wants it, okay? And he chooses a course of action where the weighted average of the utilities over that course of on the outcomes of that course of action, where the weights are given by the probability that the course of action will have the outcome, he chooses the course of action that maximizes that weighted average. Okay? So probabilities come in because they assign it, because they're important for doing the weights in the weighted average on the utility of the outcome of an action, given that the action may have several outcomes, ranked according to their likelihood. Okay, the weights are the likelihoods, right? That the action has this effect. And then utilities tell you how much I want that effect. So essentially what you're doing, right, in probability theory, you will see this equation later in the course. So the action you choose, oh look, my thing's still up. So the action you choose is the one, argmax, for every outcome of that action, it's the probability of that action, given that I've performed A, times its utility, right? That's the weighted average of the utility, right? So you're looking for actions that maximize that weighted average. The weights being the probability of the outcome given the action. Okay? That's decision theory. Now, according to decision theory, that's the rational thing to do. We all act this way. We sit there weighing up likelihoods of our outcomes with the degree to which we want them, and we search for an optimal trade-off on that, okay? Do we? Hands up who thinks we do. Hands up who thinks we don't. Mm-hmm. Well, you guys don't. But you're not the only ones, right? Here are the results of that experiment I did on you on Tuesday, right? I gave you, at the beginning of the lecture, the choice between lotteries A and B. A is, you've got an 80% chance of getting 4,000, B is 100% chance of 3,000. Actually, I flipped them here, sorry. But anyway, it's the same structure. And then C, a 20% chance of 4,000, D, 25% chance of 3,000. Now, only 19% of you went for the risky one between A and B, okay? In that you went for the big money, okay? And were prepared to take the risk that you'd get nothing. All of you went for C over D, all of you. Is that rational to pick B and C? That combination? Well, no, it's not. Because whatever the utility of money, and incidentally, the utility of money is not equal to the amount of money. I'll show you the curve, the utility of money, in a minute. But whatever its utility, what you were comparing between A and B was the utility of 3,000 times 0.8 over the utility of 4,000. Okay? Because the alternative, this is the weighted average expected, you know, this expected outcome on lottery B, is its probability, the probability of an outcome times its utility. Now, the utility of no gain in money is zero. I am assuming that. Okay. If you don't gain money, you gain nothing, I'm saying. Right? So its weighted average is 0.8 times the utility of 4,000. There's only one outcome of the other lottery, and that's the utility of 3,000. Okay? That is the sum you compare when you decide which course of action to take, namely choose A or choose B. Now, which one you take actually depends on your own utility of money, right? For that one. It's not necessarily the case that you're comparing 3,000 with whatever this is, 500. 5,000, sorry, or whatever, 500. Okay, it's not necessarily the case you're doing that. But I then gave you this lottery. Now for that, the weighted average, in other words, these expected utilities, are these guys, right? If this is greater than this, this is greater than this. All I've done is divided the ratios by four. The ratio's the same, right? And yet what you guys did was choose that and choose that. That is not rational, because if this is greater than this, this is greater than that. So it is rational to choose A and C. It is rational to choose B and D. But it's not rational to flip those, right? To choose B and C. Everyone who chose B chose C. And that was a lot of you. Okay. Don't worry, you're not alone, okay? This is absolutely the way humans work, okay? The decision theory gives you a very idealized notion of rational action. It's very idealized. And humans, against that benchmark, are irrational. And in fact, what's interesting about human behavior is that they're irrational in very systematic and predictable ways. I mean, that's why I was completely confident in what you were going to do, how you were going to react to this experiment. It's totally robust. Whether you do it with people like you, or whether you do, you know, who are undergraduates at Edinburgh University, whether you do it to my mum, whether you do it to, you know, children even, who at least understand enough about money, they go for the freebie. There is something about something for nothing that makes a difference to us, right? There's something about a free lunch, which is essentially what B is here, that makes us just, it takes this it has this special status in our decision-making processes, which the maths of decision theory just ignores. Okay, that's what was playing up here. But there are other ways in which we're irrational against that decision theoretic benchmark in very kind of predictable and systematic ways. I could give a whole course on that, but I can't. I'm not allowed. Go do cognitive science if you want to find out about that stuff, right? About the vagaries of human reasoning and human inference. What I'm working with here is a very idealized form as used by economists. Yes, and we all know what trouble we got in with them, right, over the last few years. So I'll just then briefly put up what the utility of money is, although I will probably talk about this later in the course as well. The utility of money, right, so this is the degree to which I want something, okay? This is how much money I have, or how much I'm in debt if I'm on this line, right, here's zero, okay? So if I'm in this area, I'm in debt. If I'm in this area, I'm in the black. Now, the utility of money is not linear. It's not like that. It varies from one individual to another, for sure. But it's certainly not linear for anybody. Rather, it looks much more like this. Oh, never goes down. It kind of asymptotes like this. Okay? In other words, if you don't have much in your bank account, it makes a massive difference to you whether you gain a little or lose a little. Okay? If, on the other hand, you're Abramovich, you will take much more risk to gain, to get big bucks. It's worth it to you. Because to get into a more desirable state is going to take a lot more money than if you were sitting down here. Okay? Conversely, if you're, I can't think of someone who's in major trouble. Anyway, Greece. Right? Poor Greece. It's terrible. My relatives are in a dreadful state. Anyway, well, that's where I think Greece is going wrong. They actually aren't taking risks, and they're being handcuffed from taking risks with the economy. Right? And they need to take those risks to improve their lot. They really do need to go for big payoffs, however unlikely those might be. And, you know, Germany's stopping them from doing that. Okay? So the utility of money looks something like this. Now, the extent to which, the extent to which individuals like to gamble, basically the curve shape looks like this for everybody. But if you're a real gambler, it tends to be flatter towards the zero mark and asymptotes quicker than if you're a very risk-averse person. Okay. And you kind of don't like to potentially lose any money you've got, however small, then your curve tends to be steeper around the zero mark and steeper for longer. Okay. That varies from one individual to another. That's a personality trait. But the curves look like that. Nevertheless, that's just maths, right? That's just two things divided, you know, one's divided a quarter of the other, right? There's nothing we can do about that. So it's irrational, whatever your particular utility of money, to choose B and C, okay? Never mind. It's fine. It may be irrational, but actually, that doesn't mean it's wrong. Okay, so so this is what we're aiming for here. I mean, so it's not human behavior, but it's some kind of idealized form of rational behavior. We're going to focus on probability and not utility for now. But what we're aiming for is an agent who reasons about the states it's in, reasons about the actions it could perform in that state, and the outcomes of those actions, and the extent to which it wants those actions, according to this formula. Okay, so what it's trying to do is determine a mapping from
any state it might find itself in into a policy, as they're called, i.e. a course of actions that maximises this sum, this weighted average, this maximising expected utility. And it's doing that all the time. Once it's performed the first action in this in its policy, it will do its sensing actions to see, all right, well, I expected this outcome. Is this the outcome, or am I in some weird unexpected state? And work out the policy from that, right? So it's sensing and then using the mapping from states to best policy to implement the policy, sensing again, implementing the policy from the state it finds itself in, and so on and so on. But at all points, it's basically doing this sum every time it wants to act, okay? After it senses where it is. And of course, sensing where it is, it may not have a complete... It may be not a completely observable environment, so it's also assessing the likelihood of where it is, which of course influences this value, the probability of the outcome given the action. Okay. All right, but we're going to ignore this bit of the equation for a bit, right? This utility stuff, and we're going to work just on probabilities for a bit. Okay. And conditional probabilities in particular, but I will do conditional probabilities only a little bit today, and then next week we'll talk about joint probabilities. So first of all, a bunch of jargon, okay? Right, so we've got random variables, okay? Those variables take values that we might not know for sure what the value of a variable is. It's in that sense, it's random, okay? Because, in principle at least, I might not know the value of the variable. But I do know its domain. In other words, I know what possible values it could have. I just don't know which particular value it has. Now, there are many kinds of variables. There's the Boolean ones. So I've treated cavity as a Boolean here, right? So either I've got a cavity or I haven't. Either I'm dead or I'm not. Either I'm pregnant or I'm not. Right? There are some things that are just true or false. And then there are variables that have several discrete values, but a finite number of discrete values. You can think of the weather a bit like this, or some aspects of the weather, right? So a weather can be cloudy, sunny, rain, or snow, or wind, for example. I mean, that's how the BBC reports it, right? You could likewise think of some aspects of the weather in terms of continuous random variables like temperature, wind speed, okay? All of things that I may not know the specific value, but I might have a probability distribution over the values. Now, atomic events are essentially what states were in PDDL. It's a complete specification of the state you're in. And for any two distinct atomic events, they can't both be true at the same time. They're mutually exclusive. Okay? And the set of atomic events is exhaustive. In other words, that fully describes every possible state you could ever encounter. Okay? So every event entails a specific value for every random variable that's part of your domain. So they're like models in logic, right? Giving you truth values for the literals, okay? All right, so I spoke earlier about prior probabilities. That's the unconditional, guys. That's my degree of belief in something in the absence of any evidence whatsoever. So I may assess the likelihood that I have a cavity in the absence of any information to be relatively low, like 0.1. Okay, so you can write it in one of two ways. These are notational variants, really. This is the probability that my random variable cavity equals true is 0.1. Or you can write it with a small c. And the opposite, the probability that I don't have a cavity, would be written not cavity with a small c. Right, so you can write for Boolean variables where... There's a convention that variables start with a capital letter, right? Cavity with a small c is a notational variant for assigning the variable true. And false, I've lost me rubber. Oh, here it is. If it's false, do not count it. Okay? Now, you can have a probability distribution over all the values that weather can take, a random variable can take. So imagine a random variable weather that takes three possible values. Here is a probability distribution over them. You can write it this way. This assumes, this is a vector representing the probability distribution. Of course, you've got to have a convention about the order of the values in that vector for the random variable. Notice they sum to one. Why? One's got to always be true, right? Given what atomic events are, one of them has to be true. So it's got to sum to one. All right. Now, probability distributions. Now that we've got probability distributions over individual variables, we can have probability distributions over joint values for several variables. Combinations of values, I should say, for several variables. And they're known as joint probability distributions, or the cross product. So I can talk about the probability that I have a cavity in the weather, sunny, for example. Okay. So you can also talk about the conditional probability. This is the posterior probability idea. The probability of A given B. Right? In other words, the degree of belief I would have in A if I believed B would be a way of thinking about this. Okay? So, for example, although my prior probability for cavities is relatively low at 0.1, if I believe I've got toothache, if I observe, and, you know, let's suppose my beliefs about that are reliable, right? If I've got toothache, I'll detect it. Then my probability, my posterior probability that I've got cavity is shot up, right? Because the probability of a cavity given toothache is 0.8, not 0.1. Okay? Okay, so what about conditional probabilities and their relationships to joint probabilities? Well, this is where dependence versus independence really begins to bite among random variables. You probably recognize this from your Maths for Inf classes or from whatever maths experience you've got, right? This is essentially Bayes' rule in action. So the probability that A given B is the joint probability over the probability of B. You might also see it written as a product this way. Or you might see it written as the probability of A given B is the probability of B given A times the probability of A. That's another way you might see it written. Over the probability of B. Okay? In other words, intuitively, for A and B to be true, right, for this thing to be true, we've got to make B true and then make A true given that B is true. Alternatively, we make A true first and make B true given A is true. So this thing is also equal to the probability of B given A times the probability of A. The thing is symmetric, just as conjunction is symmetric. Right? Or because conjunction is symmetric. Okay? So that's why it's this product. Now, it's true to say that if the probability, if X and Y are independent, then the joint probability distribution is the distribution, is the product of their priors. Why is that? Well, if, for example, the weather is independent of whether I have a cavity or not. And the probability that I've got a cavity, given it's sunny, is the probability I've got a cavity. Whether it's sunny or not makes no difference to the likelihood I've got a cavity. Right? So if I plugged in cavity and sunny in here, you could see that this would just be the probability of cavity, right? And what you'd end up with is the product. But in general, that's not true, and you can't always assume it's true that you've got independence among your random variables. And conditional probabilities is a way of respecting those dependencies. the value of one variable might influence the value of another, in other words. So although this won't get at causation directly, it at least gets at statistical correlation, which for most environments in which we have to act is good enough. Okay? Here are the axioms of probability. All probabilities have to lie between 0 and 1. You've got true and false are like special propositions. Probability that it's of true is 1. Probability of false, that's like contradiction, is 0. True you can think of as logical truth. So that could be, for example, A implies A, or P or not P. The probabilities of that kind of stuff is 1. Okay? So we're doing sound inference, we're staying consistent when you're working in this probabilistic environment. This is needed to ensure that we stay sound. The probability of A or B is this sum, probability of A, probability of B, minus their joint probability. Why? Well, best way to see this is to think of it in terms of kind of Venn diagram. Here's A, here's B, okay? Let's stick in some not A and B stuff, C. Okay? So I know my event's going to lie somewhere in here, okay, within this Venn diagram. These are the A or B events. Yeah? The shaded bits. If I just took the probability of A plus the probability of B, I would count, I would count this bit twice, this little segment of orange twice. Yeah? So I've got to take one of them away. Okay, so the probability of not A is 1 minus the probability of A. And for any variable, D, with its domain, the sum of the probabilities on the values have to be 1. We saw that with weather earlier. Okay. And for any set, if we've got a set of atomic events in which A is true, then the probability of A is the sum of the probabilities over that atomic event. So that's like a generalization over this rule about individual probabilistic variables. Okay. Now, that's all you need for all of probability theory. That's it. You can derive Bayes' rule in particular from this. And one thing I guess I should say about conditional probabilities is sometimes people get confused about this. This is not the probability that A implies B. This has nothing to do with conditionals in logic, with this, or very little to do with it. Right? It is not that. Okay? If you want to see why not, think about what that is using these axioms. A implies B is the same as not B or A. Yeah? So that's the probability of not B, probability of A, minus the probability of their conjunction. And this is 1 minus the probability of B. That bears no relation to this in Bayes' rule. I hope you can see that. This is essentially the likelihood of B, given that you've observed A, but it's not, this is saying something else. This is material conditional, right? It's a weird guy, actually. That does not necessarily correlate with causation at all. Okay. I've lost my remote. Okay, so to summarise, I basically here what I've done is I've tried to set out the notion of rational decision making that we're going to aim for in the second half of this course. And it's an optimal trade-off on likelihood of the outcomes of your actions and the degree to which you want those outcomes. Forget the degree to which you want them, right? Utility theory will come later. What I'm going to focus on for a couple of weeks is probabilistic reasoning, how you reason with stuff like this, reasoning with uncertainty. Because until we can reason with uncertainty, we can't act under uncertainty. But we're going to have a little break from this because tomorrow Matt Crosby is going to take the lecture and introduce you to the second assignment on planning. Okay, so there's a little sort of break in the course tomorrow. And I'll see you on Tuesday. Are there any questions? Okay, see you Tuesday. Choices people make with that stuff. So people are sort of divided into three categories. I want it now. I'm prepared to wait for my rewards. I can't, and dwelling on the plots, right? And they, their utility functions reflect that. So these experiments that people do with kids, right? You can have two marshmallows in 20 minutes, or even one in front of you now. They're kind of interesting because the kids that they use that as a measure for whether they are the hedonist type and so have a utility function where any reward now is better than a reward in the future, whether they are long-term they'll be rewards in the future. And they found that people who go for the future do better at school, get better careers, earn more, have more stable marriages, more family, and all this kind of thing. They follow the kids through. I don't think that's, I mean, that's not hyperbolic discounting, though, is it? I mean, it's probably not what you're talking about, but.
Yeah.
There's, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I don't know. I mean, this is a big picture.
Thank you.
of B given A is the probability of B. The probability of A given B is the probability of A.
Is the joint probability, right? The product. If I go here, and where's my little thingy?
Oh.
Like, dude, I think I just said to me, like, what track is it?